Yes. So what happens is the nursing home then, she's just asked if people can then visit. It depends, that they won't take a person or call the funeral director until the family have been advised and the family can choose to go and see them or not. Now, the good thing is that most nursing homes, private hospitals and that, most of them have private rooms there. There's a couple of private hospitals that have what we generally call the flyaway room or whatever, where they've got a room set aside like a little chapel where they can take someone to be with their family after they've died. Okay, so they will find out if the family want to attend. If the family want to attend, they can, and after the family have been, then the funeral director can attend. If someone dies in a public hospital, it's a different situation. You still will have the opportunity for the family to go and see them. However, the funeral directors can only go into public hospitals Monday to Friday on certain hours. Okay, because the body has to go through their mortuary and their mortuary system. And we can't pick them up as a funeral director until the paperwork has been filled out by the treating doctor. So, what people struggle with this, because what happens is mum's died on Friday afternoon in the Royal Adelaide and the funeral director's telling them we won't be able to look at picking them up until Tuesday. And that is commonplace, simply because they have to go through their mortuary system, which is not running properly on the weekends, and they have to be released by their orderlies. And so you will not get paperwork signed until after ward rounds on the next working day, which would be Monday. So at about 2 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the paperwork would be signed by the clinicians who were treating them. And then after that, they can be released to the funeral director, but the mortuary closes at 2 o'clock. So the funeral directors can't get them till Tuesday.
And if there's a public holiday?
It's another day. And so we just have to explain that to people. Unfortunately, you are just going to have to wait in the public hospital system. Now, sometimes we get them out within a day, but it's pretty rare. Country hospitals are usually a lot better because the doctors are more accessible. And usually in a country hospital, you've got to see... I mean, if the doctor goes away for the weekend, you're still going to be in strife. Maybe I better hold on to that so I can pass it out. So
I have a question. Can I ask the... what about organ donation?
Organ donation, yes.
How does that fit into all of this?
That's a really difficult question. Basically, organ donation is quite complicated. We assume that if you want to donate your body to the university for organ donation, if you want to donate your body for parts of your body for organ donation, then you actually usually have to have organised that beforehand, not just with your driver's licence, but the family have to agree to that as well. So your next of kin or your power of attorney has to agree to your organ donation. And most of the organs they want are good, fresh, healthy organs. Now, we have this every time I see or read articles about there not being enough organs for donation in Australia, it always makes me think, why? Because just about every single person I know on their driver's licence has ticked that they want to be an organ donor. The problem is that the organs they want for donation need to be young, healthy, good condition. And if you have organs which are young and healthy and in good condition and you die, usually the coroner wants to know why. And part of the autopsy process is dissecting most of those tissues. In fact, about the only tissues that you can still use after the coroner's been involved is corneas. And that's simply because the corneas don't have a blood supply. So if we want to know why there's not enough organs around, it's not because people don't want to be organ donors, it's because the way the coroner's works in Australia is that they usually take some time to get the body ready for an autopsy, and then the organs are dissected as part of the autopsy so they're completely unsuitable for donation. So really the only time that we get organs from, for example, someone who's been in a car accident or they've died from something like an asthma attack is when they've kept the person alive on respirators for quite some time, long enough, 2 or 3 days, long enough for the doctors to establish what the cause of death is, be prepared to write a death certificate so they're not referred to the coroner. Does that make sense? So it's not that people don't want to be organ donors, it's just that the problem is the coroners usually dissect the organs. Now, slowly, very slowly around this country, coroners are moving to virtual autopsies. And by that I mean instead of taking all the organs out and looking at them and going through the physiology of them that way, they're doing it by MRI. South Australia has only been doing that for the last 18 months, and there are still plenty of times when they will still do a physical autopsy because the MRI is inconclusive. Let me go down the back. I'll give you a mic.
Thank you. My question is, what if you want to leave what's left of your body to medical science?
Yep. What if you want to make a body donation to the university? Okay, good question. The university, believe it or not, doesn't take everyone. The university is really quite specific about when it wants bodies and what sort of bodies it wants. And it's partly because in the last 20 years, we've developed, and believe it or not, South Australia is at the forefront of developing embalming chemicals that are now being used all around the world. In fact, they were developed about 7 kilometres from here at Glynde. And there's a company at Glynde that has been working on embalming chemicals to preserve bodies for long term. So, at the University of Adelaide, in their Department of Anatomy, where they would do all their keep all their cadavers, when I went to medical school, everything was refrigerated. And so when you got the body out, or the limb or whatever you had to do dissection on, two things happened. Number one, it was very grey. Your eyes would water from all the formalin in it. And it was always very cold because they were refrigerated, and you might get 18 months to 2 years out of a particular specimen, and then they had to be disposed of. The Adelaide University now no longer has anything in refrigeration. The embalming chemicals are so good that they don't need them in refrigeration and they will last for 20 to 30 years. And so as a consequence of that, the university doesn't need anywhere near as many donations as it used to have. Also, if you want to donate your body to the university, you have to organise it before you die. Your body has to be pretty much intact, like they're not interested in deceased people who are missing a leg or missing a kidney or a lung or anything like that. They want the specimens to be in good condition and to be pretty much intact. And the other thing is you have to die at the right time of the year. So you actually have to die at a time of the year when all their medical students and that don't need the bodies and they don't need to do the embalming. So if you die, for example, between November and February, there's a very good chance, even if everything else is okay, that the university won't want you, for the simple reason they don't have the staff in there to deal with you at the time. But we need less and less bodies at the university because the embalming chemicals have improved dramatically. And as I said, well, they don't even use refrigeration there anymore. And the bodies, you can work on them without dying of formalin poisoning as well. Okay. If you're interested, afterwards, I've got some flow charts here to basically explain, if you're really interested, what happens when someone dies at home or at a nursing home or in a private hospital or in a public hospital and how it differs slightly between them. I think I've done about 15 copies of each, so I'll leave those there, and if people want to have a look at those and follow through a flow chart so you know how it works, you're welcome to them. Okay. Now, I mentioned the coroner a minute ago. Do you know much about the coroner? Who the coroner is, what they do?
Well, there's a TV show.
There's a TV show, yep. In fact, you know, there's no point in telling you what an autopsy is because, I mean, I could bring graphic videos in here, but they're on YouTube. You can see as gory an autopsy as you want on YouTube. Everything's on the internet these days, particularly that. So it's, well, they're on there. The coroner is a legal officer whose job it is to determine the cause of death and any contributing causes of death. Now, the other weird thing with our legal system is the coroner's job is to investigate all those deaths and also fires. That's just a weird thing in our law in this country. The coroner's job is also to investigate if you have a house fire, whether anyone's injured or not, it needs to be investigated. So the coroner is a legal officer who is usually someone like a magistrate, and they employ two groups of people. They employ forensic scientists and they employ people in coronial services who tend to be police officers. So the coronial services, when there's a death, the coronial service people will determine, for example, the situation around that death. If it was a car accident, what percentage of blame is the driver of that car responsible for, and things like that. If it's a homicide, who's committed the homicide? The forensic science people, on the other hand, as opposed to coronial services, the forensic science people look at the body and their job is to determine what has actually killed that person. So sometimes you might think it's very obvious because you've attended a car accident and there's the person sitting in the car there and there's their head over there. You think, well, it's fairly obvious what they've died from. They've been decapitated. But as I said, they need to determine the cause of death and any contributing causes of death. So we don't only need to know were they decapitated, that's obvious, but did they have any drugs in their system? Did they have any alcohol in their system? Did they black out? What were the things that caused the eventual death? So that's the role of the coroner. They have to investigate those things. And sometimes the reality is they don't find out the definitive cause of the death. And a classic example of that, which you would all be aware of, is cot death. Okay? Now, what causes cot death? We still don't know, but what are the contributing causes of death? We do know. So if babies are left on their stomach or if they're too hot or all of these things, we know what sort of things will increase the risk of cot death, but we don't know exactly, definitively, what causes it. So the coroners have investigated all those deaths to determine what has actually contributed to the death, but they still can't isolate exactly or put their finger on it and say, this is what causes it. So that's the role of the coroner, and they employ policemen and policewomen, and they also have people who work particularly on doing autopsies and determining the cause of death according to what the physical features of the body are telling them. And you've all seen shows on television that always manage to find this out in about, usually about 47 minutes, or the time the show takes to get through. And I think that's, I love that to bits. I can remember watching one of the American embalmers one day, and he was showing us some video clips of CSI Miami in their mortuary. And then he showed us clips and photographs that he'd taken in the CSI Miami actual mortuary with all the broken floor tiles and the ceiling fans missing a prong. And I mean, it was horrendous. And so all of these things where they get the answers and they get DNA results in 15 minutes on television is very, very nice, and I'm sure the police would wish that it was the truth, but it's a long, long way from it. And the forensic work is just a lot of hard slog a lot of the time and waiting for results. I should say a little bit more about that, but I'll quickly run through a few other things as well. I've used the term autopsy. You've probably also heard the term post-mortem. They're exactly the same thing. One's from the Greek, one's from the Latin, that's all. But a post-mortem and an autopsy are identical things. When I was asked tonight to talk a little bit about prepaid funerals as well, just to tell you a little bit about what that's all about. Since I retired, I've discovered that I think every second ad on television all during the day and after about 11 o'clock at night is for funerals and funeral services and prepaid funerals. Basically, with prepaid funerals, there's a couple of ways of doing this. You can take out a prepaid funeral with a funeral company, a specific company. And what happens is you put money into an account and that money gains interest, which pays for the increase in costs of the funeral. So you pay for the funeral at today's prices. The money is invested. It's not allowed to be invested by the funeral company. It has to be invested by a third party. Alfred James used a company called Funeral Plan Management, which had something like 150,000 prepaids from all around the country in it and over $10 billion invested in it. That money gets invested, and when the person dies in 5 years, 10, 20 years' time, the interest that that money has raised pays for all the increases in the charges. Now, that's a standard prepaid funeral. And some companies do it in lump sum, some do it in instalments, in others they can do it weekly or monthly over a set period of time. And that pays for the funeral, and then when the death occurs, the money comes out of the account. You'll also hear of funeral insurance and funeral bonds. Now, the difference with insurance and bonds is you're not forking out the amount of money to start with, but you're forking out a certain amount of money every couple of weeks or every month or whatever. But that's for a set amount of benefit at the end. So you actually have to stipulate how much you want to get out of that. And if the funeral happens to go over the price of that at the time of the death, then you will have to pay, or the family will have to pay, the balance of that. So that's what the funeral bonds are. And there's all sorts of different groups that do them. I'm not sure. I don't think the Uniting Church does it. UC Invest does it, but the Catholics and quite a few different groups do it as well.
Now, the benefit of that is that Centrelink doesn't consider it as an asset.
Correct.
And it's just a term deposit. Yes. That I have to pay tax on.
Correct. The prepaid funerals with a funeral company are also not part of the income and asset tests as well. So if you've got a prepaid... The good thing these days is that the money is not held by the funeral company. The money is held in trust by a third party. So the funeral company cannot get the money until the person actually dies. I need to tell you, though, that in spite of what it says on some of these ads, where they're going to pay you out immediately and your family will be reimbursed immediately for the cost of the funeral, that's a load of rubbish. No funeral policy, whether it's a prepaid funeral or a life insurance policy or a funeral insurance policy, will pay out until a copy of the death certificate is received. Okay? Now, death certificates are applied for by the funeral company, and then they are received straight by the family from the Department of Births, Deaths and Marriages. Most of the time, it occurs within about 3 to 4 weeks of the death. But if the person goes to the coroner's and gets autopsied, you can pretty much guarantee the death certificate could take 12 to 18 months. It takes a lot longer, and the insurance policies will not pay out until... That's one of the differences between the funeral companies and having your own private policy, is the funeral companies will pay for the funeral. But the insurance policies will not pay out until a copy of the death certificate is received. And the reason they take so long when the body goes to the coroner's is because some of the tests the coroner does takes 5 or 6 months to get a result. They will take tissue scrapings or they'll take bacterial tests, put them in a petri dish and stick them in an incubator for 5 months to get a result. And so they can't issue a death certificate with a cause of death and contributing causes of death until they get all their results in.
So that means the person can't be buried or cremated?
Person can be buried or cremated these days.
Oh, right.
There's nothing to stop that these days. It used to be when I started that if you were... it was tougher than that even. When I started, it was a situation if someone died as a result of a homicide, that they couldn't be buried or cremated until someone had actually been apprehended. Which was why they had somebody sitting in the coroners that had been there for 20 years. It was ridiculous. But now you can. It doesn't stop you having the funeral service. It just means you won't get your money out of the life insurance.
And uniting whatever it is, what's it called?
Uniting Care, yeah.
No.
UC Invest.
Oh, UC Invest, yes.
Yeah, sorry, the investment company. You have to show your that you've paid the account for the funeral before they reimburse you.
Yeah, okay. That's how they choose to do it. Some of the other companies do it a bit differently as well. Are you not?
Isn't it?
Okay.
This one working?
Yeah.
When Jenny died, we had a funeral fund with UC Invest. The account went straight to UC Invest, and UC Invest paid the funeral company.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I understood that, you know, the kids had to pay for it.
No, well... Not with the UC Invest Funeral Fund.
Well, that's nice to hear, because I know, for example, a company like Alfred James don't like to send it to a company like UC Invest. Likewise, they don't like to send it to an executor trustee. They would rather send the bill to the family and get the family to pass it on to executor trustee for the simple reason it gets paid about 5 times quicker. If we just send the bill to executor trustee... it sits on a desk somewhere there for about 4 months before anyone even notices it.
Regarding paying for a funeral...
Yes?
I'm a retired Uniting Church minister who was out in the rural area,
mm-hmm.
and I discovered that in the case of when a person dies and they absolutely have no money whatsoever... the government can pay for it, or somebody pays for it, but it's that was I'm talking about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a particular funeral business
mm-hmm.
that would take on the situation. It had to be that the person had no money and their children had no money at all. So is that still the case? Or?
Yes. There are still things... we used to call them pauper's funerals. You've heard of those? Different funeral companies, every couple of years, they take out the contract with Centrelink to see who wants to run those. And for about the last 15 years, the company that has been doing that is a company called Fulham Funerals. And Fulham Funerals have basically said, look, we will do those government-paid funerals. It's exactly as you said. Basically, the person has to have no money or assets themselves, and they can't have any children who have got any assets or even a job. So, the funeral directors don't make that stipulation. Centrelink makes the distinction as to who is entitled to these funerals and who isn't. And the funerals are extremely basic. So they're usually held at a non-priority time. So the funeral might be at 1 or 2 o'clock, or 12 to 1 o'clock, or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, basically when no one else wants a funeral. And it's a very basic funeral, either a burial or a cremation. At one stage, the company that I worked for was doing those contracts. And we used to get a bit sick of the families who'd say we had no money or whatever, and then they'd turn up in a stretched limousine. And you used to think, well, really, you know, because the funeral companies are probably losing money with each of them. But there is different companies that have the opportunity to apply for that. For about the last 15 years, it's been awarded to Fulham Funerals, and so they're doing those funeral services.
Can I make a comment?
I'd just like to make a comment, and I know that the situation with this, I had one experience with this, and I know that the situation was really true, that there was no asset, but I also wanted to say how beautifully gracious the funeral people were.
Yeah, look, they do a good job. And just because the family haven't got any money, most funeral companies will still do that job. When I can remember when we had the contract, there was a number of times when I was conducting the funeral service and I'd get out to the graveside and there was me and the minister. That was it. But we would still have a full funeral service for the person because it's about the dignity of the individual as well.
Ian, can just share an anecdote. And I can't remember which funeral director it was, but it was West Terrace. It was one of these community welfare ones.
Yep.
And walking from the car park to the graveside, walking alongside a lady who was somewhat intellectually challenged. "We're here to bury Mum today, but me sister's just given birth. Life goes on, doesn't it?"
Just before I leave prepaid funerals completely, one of the reasons a lot of people do prepaid funerals or take out funeral bonds and organise their funeral is because they've got a split family. They want to take the responsibility off their family, so they're making the decisions for what they want themselves, and that's all quite legitimate, and I'd suggest that's probably why most people do it. Most people who've been through arranging a funeral realise just how difficult it is. All the information that's required by the funeral directors, even just to register the death, to give you an idea. Imagine we're talking about your grandmother who's just died. This is the information we need. We need her name in full, that's easy. Her gender, easy, female. Her current residential address. Her date of birth, her place of birth, if she was an immigrant, when did she migrate to Australia, how long has she been here, is she retired, her profession or occupation. We go through this with every single family. Are they Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander? Their marital status, their date and place of marriage. How are you going with that with Grandma? The full name, maiden name and date and place of birth of each spouse. So Elizabeth Taylor would have fun going through hers, wouldn't she? We also need to know the full name, maiden name, place and date of birth of the current partner or spouse, the name and dates of birth of each legal child. If they have legally adopted them, we need to know all of those as well. We need to know the deceased person's parents' names and occupations, and their mother's maiden name. So if we're talking about your grandmother, we're talking now 5 generations ago. And that is the information that the Registrar of Births, Deaths and Marriages needs so that they make sure that they register the right person as having died.
So do they need their divorce date and everything if they've been remarrying?
No, we don't need divorce dates. Not required. But we do need to know dates and places of the marriages. And so sometimes that's very complicated and very difficult, particularly, for example, if we're dealing with people who migrated here at the end of the Second World War. And when we're talking about, because they've got no paperwork usually for what happened during the war or before the war. I always used to love many of the Vietnamese arrangers that I would do. We had asked, you not only had to put down all the children's names, which were challenging in itself, but you also had situations with many of the Asian countries where, as you would know, when someone gets married, they don't take on their spouse's surname. In fact, quite often when they get married, they take on their mother's maiden name and all sorts of intricacies like that. And then you've got to try and work out with this particular name, is this male or female? And so I've gone to the point of asking if people had their passports and discovering that this woman is not who this is. And I'm thinking, yes, this young girl is not 48 years old male. So it's quite difficult at times. Yep. Yes.
So
we'll get you the microphone. Yep.
So what happens if some of that information is just not available?
Right.
I know a South Sudanese woman that was born in a camp in Uganda, and she has no idea of the date of her birth.
Yeah.
She has no idea where her family are, or anything like that. So what happens in a case like that? She's going to die in Australia. What's going to happen?
Yeah, she doesn't have to come from the South Sudan. There's plenty of people in Australia who have no idea who their parents were or exactly when they were born. There's many orphans who've been through exactly the same experience. And what happens is when you get your copy of your death certificate, it will simply have unknown. In those categories that you can't fill in, it will say unknown. Okay, so that's really the only issue that you're going to have. So it's not the be-all and end-all, but sometimes some of the insurance policies do make it a little bit more difficult to pay out if there's a lot of unknowns on the documentation.
Put their date of birth as the 1st of January in the year.
Yeah, I understand that. It's a different culture altogether, isn't it? Yeah. I can remember talking to some people who'd just come from the Sudan and they were coming in a car from the airport and they saw someone jogging and it freaked them out. We had no idea why until they were trying to work out who was chasing them. Yeah. You know, and... Yeah. To give you an idea of what funerals basically cost, for a basic funeral, just to give you an idea, basic cremation at Centennial Park using one of the cheapest coffins, about $10,500. Basic burial at Centennial Park, $17,700. That's if you have to purchase a new licence. The other big crematorium is Enfield. For a cremation there, $10,600, so $100 more. Cheapest burial at Enfield is just on $20,000. Now, that's not including things like limousines and memorial cards and flowers and all those other bits and pieces that we add on. But that gives you an idea of the sort of costs that are involved in actually paying for a funeral. And all of the funeral companies have got different ways that they charge for things. And there are two basic ways that funeral companies get money. One is from the sale of their coffin, and the other one is from their service charge, because all the funeral companies pay exactly the same amount to the advertiser. We all pay the same. Most funeral companies, believe it or not, use the same printers. And so if you want to have memorial cards or DVDs done, all that, most funeral companies use the same printers and DVD people. So even, for example, Enfield Memorial Park use the same DVD producers as most of the funeral companies because they're used to doing it and they do it very, very quickly and accurately. Now, the microphone I'll just send over here.
Could you just repeat those costs at Centennial Park so I can...
Cremation, $10,500 for a cremation. $10,500 for a cremation at Centennial Park. I can't be any more precise than that because there's three chapels up there and there are three different prices, and the prices also alter depending on what day of the week it is. Yes. So, cremation, $10,500. Burial was $17,700.
So, if you don't want one of the chapels, you just want to be cremated, how do you do it cheaply?
Yes. Cheapest way to have a funeral service is this. And before COVID struck, COVID had quite a big influence on the funeral industry because all of a sudden we couldn't do funeral services. And if you can remember, when COVID first struck here in South Australia, we not only went into lockdown, but then we went to a stage where you could only have 10 people at a funeral. And that 10 people had to include the funeral director and the minister. So all of a sudden, you could have 7 or 8 people at a funeral service. So most people chose not to. They had what is called a disposition funeral. Now, a disposition funeral is the cheapest way to have a funeral service in this country. And before COVID set in, the previous 5 years before COVID set in, disposition funerals had gone from about 2% of funerals to about 9.8%. When COVID set in, it went from 9.8% to about 65% of funerals. And what happens with a disposition funeral is there is no formal funeral service. So the funeral directors collect the body, the family can have a viewing and do an identification, and then the body is simply taken to Centennial Park or Enfield, or usually Northern Regions Crematorium at Gawler because it's cheaper. And then the family get the cremated remains back. And the family can choose to have a memorial service where and when they like. And so the family can choose to have a church service at Morialta Uniting Church. The only difference between that and another funeral service is you don't have the coffin present. Okay, so you still have a service. You can have hymns, you can have eulogies, you can have DVD presentations, but what you don't have is the coffin there because the person has already been dealt with. That's exactly the sort of funeral I'm having. My wife's a registered nurse and she doesn't need to have my coffin sitting in the front of Brown Place Uniting Church and her sitting in the front row 10 feet from me to realise that I'm dead. She's quite happy to do that. And as I said, even before COVID came in, about 9.8% of funerals in this country were disposition funerals. And the cost of the funeral drops down to about $6,000 to $7,000. You still have to have a coffin because the body has to be dealt with in something. You can't just put a body in a cremator. It has to be in a coffin.
Cardboard or paper or rushes or whatever?
Let's talk about that. Okay. Cardboard coffins are not cardboard. They look like it, but they're about 65% timber because whatever you use to bury or cremate someone has to meet the workplace health and safety standards of the people operating the crematorium. And when a coffin goes into a cremator, it actually sits, the cremators are not turned off in between cremations. They are scraped out and the remains are removed from the cremator, but the cremator is still running at about 1,050 degrees Celsius. Okay? So the metal rakes can only be in there for a matter of seconds before they melt. The coffin that goes in next is placed on tines of what looks like a long forklift tine. And the coffin, the cremator door is opened. The coffin goes in on these tines. It is dropped onto the heap bricks and this comes out. And that is done in a process that takes about 2.5 seconds or the steel tines start to melt. Okay, so it has to be done. It has to be done quite quickly. No, it doesn't roll in because the rollers simply wouldn't survive in there. The whole internal of the cremating oven is all brick. It's actually like Besser blocks. It's solid concrete Besser blocks. And that's what the inside of the cremator is made out of. And so the remains come out one end, another coffin then can go in the front end of the cremator. Takes about 1.5 hours to do a cremation. And all you get out of that, you'll hear funeral directors don't like using the term ashes because people think they're going to go and pick up mum's ashes and it's going to weigh about, you know, 1/4 pound. Instead, when they go and pick them up, they discover it weighs about 4.5 pound. They're quite heavy because what you get is granulated bone. You do not get ash. The amount of ash from a coffin doesn't even take a matchbox. Wouldn't even fill a matchbox.
What about those of us who've got two artificial hips and other
things? Artificial hips and any artificial bits and pieces that you have that are made of titanium will come out of the cremator and they will be taken away and just depends on what the cremators are doing with them at the time. Sometimes they're taken over to Europe and they're melted down and reused. the metal scrapyard. Yeah. Well, some of your bits were. Now, I was talking about what got me onto that was talking about things like cardboard coffins and that. Now, if you had a coffin and all that was in the bottom was cardboard, the body would just fall out of that in no time. And so the cardboard coffins are actually, they've got a wooden shell inside them that goes up just past the level of where the handles are, so the coffin can still be moved easily by the people who are having to handle it at the crematorium or the cemetery. And then the whole thing is covered in cardboard to make it look like cardboard. So they're technically cardboard-covered coffins, but they're still 60% timber. And the stupid thing is, when I was working at Alfred James, the cheapest cardboard coffin, well, we had two timber ones that were cheaper than that in our range. So they're not particularly cheap. There is a wicker coffin as well that is available. I don't know how much they are. And I think if you really want to get interested, I think Costco actually sell a couple of coffins as well. You'll find they're not particularly cheap either. Like they're up in the $2,000 to $3,000 mark. So,
I think you're making it up yourself, don't you?
Well,
comes with an Allen key.
Yeah.
They
can be buried in a shroud if they're a particular religion. And there's the other thing that people sometimes ask about is natural earth burials as well. Because, I mean, most of the time when people are buried in shrouds, it's in one of the natural earth cemeteries or environmental cemeteries. And we've got a couple of those in Adelaide. Enfield's got an area called Wirrawonga, which is for natural earth burials, and then Smithfield Cemetery has an area called Pilliyata, which are obviously Aboriginal terms. I think one's for running water and another one's peaceful skies, or something like that. So they're Aboriginal names for areas set aside in the cemetery. The difficulty with those areas is that you have the burial there, and the body either has to be in a shroud that's then buried or in a wooden coffin, and the wooden coffin cannot have any metal things or anything like that. So the handles are all rope and they have to be no polish on them or anything like that. So they're plain pine wood coffins with hessian inside of them. When these areas of the cemeteries opened, the cemetery owners thought this is going to be great, and they thought environmentally friendly, we can make some money out of this. So when those areas opened at the cemeteries, they were actually the most expensive areas in the cemetery. Then they discovered that people were happy to be environmental at a cost. So they've now brought the prices back down to be reasonable. The difficulty with those areas is once the body has been interred in that grave, they then plant a tree in the middle of it, which means two things. Number one, they don't have any headstones on them, so the family usually can't find them again. But the other thing is you can't reuse that grave because you'd be killing the tree. So if you want to have a husband and wife buried together, they have to buy two plots side by side, what we call companion sites. So it's basically twice the price of a normal burial because you're not being buried in the same grave. Down the back there. I don't want to make you late for your cup of tea or coffee.
Oh dear, I forgot what I was going to say. Yes, I'm afraid so. Yes, so environmentally, which ones are better? Which way to go?
We were talking about this beforehand. I got asked many years ago, what's the best way to have a fully environmental funeral? I want to be as environmentally friendly as possible. And I said, that's really easy. Jump on a boat and go out in Spencer Gulf and get eaten by a white pointer. I said, either that or head up to the territory and try a crocodile. That's environmentally friendly, but it won't be very popular.
Yep.
I can't imagine a lot of people opting for that for their dear mother. Look, there's burials and cremations. I think it's personal choice. The cremations, there's a lot of things which we think are going to be environmentally friendly which don't end up being environmentally friendly. For example, about 20 years ago in England, they passed a law saying they were very concerned with all the cremations with these particle board coffins being cremated because of all the glues going up the flue and into the atmosphere. So they passed a law in England saying that the coffins had to be only made of straight timber, no particle board. And then they realised they weren't actually going to have any trees left in Europe in a very short period of time if that was the law, because they couldn't get anywhere near enough timber in. So they went back to using particle board coffins just out of necessity. So I think until we come up with some cleverer ways to deal with people, and there are a lot of things, you know, there are a lot of other alternatives and that to burials and cremations. In many other countries in the world, there are all sorts of things happening. For example, there's an and it might not sound very nice, but there's a very environmentally friendly way of disposing of a body, and that's using an alkali. And there's a number of countries in the world that currently do this, where they have a machine where your body gets put into basically a big bath of alkali and it dissolves. And what you get at the end of it is about a shoebox full of a sludge, which can then be buried in the garden. Now, I'm quite sure that people who are anti-cremation probably think that sounds a better idea than being burnt.
Sometimes they leave for the birds.
There are treetop things. There's all sorts of ways. I mean, there's some brilliant people over in England at the moment who are experimenting with a way of actually, they inject you with a mushroom mould after you die and you actually grow into mushrooms. And so, yeah, it's come from one of the universities in London. And so they've actually got the body decomposes and basically just grows thousands and thousands of these mushrooms, and the body is disposed of in that particular way. There is some creepy stuff on the horizon too. There is some creepy stuff, you know. I'll tell you a few of the creepy ones just to make it weird for you. You can actually, over in England at the moment, they can actually take tissue samples from you and extract your DNA and inject it into an apple seed and grow an apple tree from that. And so you can technically eat your own DNA by eating an apple from a tree that's got your DNA in the nuclei of the cells. There's all sorts of weird and wonderful things you can have. I mean, people go on about, wouldn't it be wonderful, you know, I'll have a tattoo of my brother on my arm. Well, what you can do now is you can actually have cremated remains placed inside the tattoo ink. Yeah, there's all sorts of weird things. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for that. And scattering the ashes yourself wherever you want to. You were saying there are no rules, so I presume...
There are rules regarding where you can scatter cremated remains.
Okay.
Basically, the rules are if you are on private property or on government property, like a national park, you are supposed to have permission of the owners of that. Now, once you do so, if you want to have your ashes scattered at Blair National Park, all you do is talk to Parks and Wildlife and get their permission, and they do it all the time. It's not a big issue. If you want to scatter your ashes in the backyard, then you can do that. The only thing you need to be aware of is that you may not have control over that land all the time. To give you an example, there's a lot of people who got very, very distressed when they discovered the football park was being turned into residential housing because all of their loved ones had been scattered at Footy Park, their cremated remains. There are a lot of people who have had their ashes scattered at Victoria Park Racecourse. I know one guy who's got his ashes scattered at the ninth green in the sand bunker at the Teacher Gully Golf Course because he was in there every Saturday. So they've scattered his ashes in there. But of course, if the golf course gets sold or you sell a house where you've had cremated remains scattered under a rose bush in the backyard, then you've got no control over that. If we have people who say they want to scatter them at home, I usually say, leave them in the plastic container, so if you do move house or Dad no longer will leave home because Mum's in the backyard, you can get her cremated remains back in that container and take her to somewhere else. The containers that they put cremated remains in are waterproof. So they're designed to be moved around at a later stage if you need to. You cannot bury someone anywhere other than in a registered cemetery unless you are an exceedingly large landholder. So if you've got 1 million acres up near Cooper Pedy or something, then you can actually set up, by law you can gazette and have your own cemetery set up there. But most of the time, 99.99% of the time, if you're having a burial, needs to be in a registered cemetery. The most of the licences in South, well, just about all of the licences in South Australia are for 50 years for a burial licence. The cremation memorials are usually 25. At the end of the 50 years, whoever is the licensee of the grave can choose to extend it if they wish to. But it tends to be quite expensive. Like my family has three graves side by side in West Terrace Cemetery, and the licences have expired, so the cemetery technically can reuse those graves, which we, you know, the family think is terrible and all the rest. And I said to them, well, we can repurchase them if we like, but you need to be aware they're $17,000 each. So if you want to fork out, you know, $51,000, I said, I've got better things to do with my money. But well, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Most of the... That would have been a little while ago. Yeah. A burial licence for 50 years is... the main cemeteries is about $4,000 to $5,000. It's a bit more expensive usually at the older cemeteries, like Cheltenham is about $7,500 or $8,000. And as I said, West Terrace is about $17,000. But there are different costs for different areas of the cemetery as well. For example, there are grave plots out at Enfield which start at $57,000. Now, these tend to be the ones that the Italians use with the above-ground vaults and that. But, yeah, there are some very expensive plots around.
Can the body be buried vertically?
Technically it can be, but it's pretty difficult to do. For one problem you've got is that the physicality of the body has no muscle tension in it anymore. So there's a very good chance if you tried to do that, the body, unless you strapped it in really solidly into the coffin, would probably push out the bottom end of the coffin. In some countries they do this all the time, like in Japan. We spoke a moment ago about the 50-year licences. In plenty of countries in the world, there is no room for burials. So in Japan, they've solved that by burying them vertically. So you can get about 10 people in the same area that you used to be able to get a standard one-person grave. The other way of doing it is to reduce the licence tenures. So if you go to Italy, for example, and you want to be buried, the cemeteries have been full for centuries. So if you want to be buried over there, what happens is you get a licence, it's for 3 years. And you have to be very careful about everything. Like, you can't have any plastic or nylon or anything artificial at all on the body, because everything has to break down within 3 years, and then the bones are put in a common ossuary and the grave can be reused. So 50 years is not bad when you consider other places, it's three.
And if you have a 25-year lease on ashes,
yep.
What happens? Can you take the ashes after that?
You can take the cremated remains and do something else with them. My father, when he died 26, 27 years ago, was cremated, and we put his cremated remains in the services family section at Centennial Park. He was a navigator in a Lancaster in the Second World War, so he's entitled to go into one of the RSL sections. Now, 25 years later, we started thinking, what are we going to do with Dad's cremated remains? We need to think about ourselves as well. So my wife and I bought 6 positions at a little cemetery at Hope Valley. and my father's ashes are now, well, cremated remains are now buried there. My wife's mother's cremated remains are there. Myself and her are going in the middle of them. And then, so we've moved him from Centennial Park to Hope Valley. No problem. I was the executor and I was the one who organised his funeral. So I had no trouble. I could have the cremated remains removed. I had to pay for it. But I can assure you Centennial Park and Enfield charge for everything. So, yeah. Yes. What time do you have to finish? It's 5:10. 5:30.
Cool. Quick comment. Being buried in a cemetery way out in the country surely would solve some problems if you've got connections there.
Yes. The reason I'm laughing about that is because you said the technical thing, if you have connections there. Now, the reason that's a good point that you bring up is, to give you an example, if you wanted to be buried at Enfield, what did I quote you for the burial? $20,000. The licence fee for a grave at Enfield is about $7,700. Now, if you wanted to be buried at somewhere like, I'll use Birdwood as an example, Birdwood Cemetery, the licence fee there is about $200. But you have to be a ratepayer, because the council runs the cemetery. So if you are going to be buried out in the country or in the Adelaide Hills, you technically have to be a ratepayer of that council to be able to access that cemetery. Because places like, for example, Gummerack started filling up with people from Tea Tree Gully who didn't want to pay the exorbitant fees at Enfield, and so they're saying, blow that, we'll go and get buried at Gummerack, which was a much nicer looking cemetery. And the licence fee at that stage was under $200. So you can be buried in the country, but be aware that there are certain cemeteries, even in the city, some of the church cemeteries, you have to be long-term members of the church. So there are restrictions on some of these cemeteries as to who can be buried there. You have to have a strong connection. Okay? So it's not quite that easy. I'll just give you a bit more information. As far as venues are where people have funerals these days, when I started in the funeral industry, about 70% of funerals were in churches. The percentage has gone from 70% to 17%. We only have about 17% of our funerals are in churches now. 44% are in funeral homes. About 25% are in crematorium chapels. 17% are in churches, as I said. 11% now are dispositions. So there is no service as such, but if the family want to have a memorial service at a later stage, they can do that. They don't tend to have too many in churches, although I've certainly done a lot of prepaid funerals for people having dispositions and then a service in the church. A lot of people choose to use things like footy clubs or pubs or outdoors in better weather than we've had today. And they can have memorial services wherever they choose to have them. So there's a lot of institutes and footy clubs and that are having memorial services there quite regularly. Some of these places where we would like to have services have actually clamped down because they were getting so many services there. And a classic one is the McGarry Room at Adelaide Oval. Now, that became so popular for having funeral services that you now can't have a service there unless you're a cricket club member there. So sometimes it got a little bit too popular. The other thing that I got asked to speak about just quickly, and I want to touch on it as well, is who are the local funeral directors? Who is still local? Because some people would still prefer to use an Australian or South Australian company rather than one of the multinationals. So I'll just give you current information as much as I know. Basically, there is a multinational USA company that owns Blackwells and Simplicity and White Lady. Also, you might remember years ago there used to be a company on Greenhill Road called Pengelly and Knabe. They were also owned by this company called Services Corporation International. So Blackwell's, White Lady and Simplicity are all owned by that American-based multinational company. Peter Elberg's for a while was bought by another American company through a subsidiary called Gianelli's, but they've since been bought back by the Elberg family, so they're back in South Australian ownership. The one which is probably most relevant for you here is that last year there is a company that's jointly owned between shareholders in Australia and New Zealand called Propel Funeral Partners. Anyone heard of them? Propel Funeral Partners? Someone's nodding. Yep. Now, Propel Funeral Partners already owned funeral homes in most states of Australia and also quite a number of cemeteries. Seems everywhere, but in South Australia you can buy a cemetery. And so they actually bought cemeteries and crematoria. They own 5 cemeteries, 19 crematoria. And they bought last year 2 South Australian companies. One of them was called Glenelg Funerals, and the other one you might have heard of called Charles Berry. So Charles Berry are not owned by the Berry's family. They are owned by a company called Propel Funeral Partners, which is a joint Australian and New Zealand multinational group or joint national group. They've, for quite a number of years, the only companies Propel have owned have been some of the companies in the country. One that they bought about 5 years ago, for example, was a company called Williams Funerals over in Port Lincoln, who were quite well known as well. So Propel actually have about 80 locations now in South Australia and around Australia and New Zealand. So they've got quite a lot of branches and cemeteries and crematoria, as I said. And as I said, last year they, I think it was about August last year, they purchased Berry's as well as Glenelg Funerals. So they're no longer technically South Australian owned either. Does anyone else have any questions or queries?
What about Bowen and Butler?
Butlers are still owned by South Australians. Sorry?
Bowen.
Des Bowen's company. Des doesn't have anything to do with it anymore. I think his daughter runs it now.
But they're still South Australian.
Yeah, still South Australian. Yep. Harrison's are still South Australian. Yes. And they've got the 2 branches, the one, the big... They've got a beautiful new... If you've never been there, they've got a stunning new chapel out at Modbury. Is it Modbury? Ridgehaven.
Yeah, Ridgehaven.
A lovely big chapel out there that holds about 400 people. So it's by far our biggest funeral service only chapel that we have in South Australia. Even Centennial Park's Hyson Chapel only holds just over half that at about 230. So the big new one out there is supposed to hold 400. So yeah, Harrison's are still South Australian owned, 5 generations. Siebert's in the city are still South Australian owned. Obviously Alfred James is still South Australian owned. They're third generation. He knows all about Alfred James. Yeah, so any other questions? No?
Can you ring around and get a good price?
Yes. There's a couple of things you can do. You can certainly ring around and get funeral companies to give you a quote. The difficulty is it's a little bit like buying a mobile phone plan. Sometimes you're not comparing apples and apples. So you do need to ask the important questions of what is their service fee and what does that actually include. So I can tell you, for example, at Alfred James, the service fee included 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if someone died at 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning at Golden Grove Nursing Home, then that was all included in the fees. If you wanted to have your loved one dressed or whatever, that was included in the fees. The way the fee altered depended on how long the funeral took. So if you were going, for example, from one location to another, for example, a church to a cemetery, it was a two-location service. If you were going to three places or four places, or there was an extended drive, for example. Do you remember last year we had that day when it just blew an absolute gale? We had about 110-kilometre-an-hour winds around South Australia, and the roads were all blocked out and you couldn't see anything. That was the day that I had a burial in Melrose, and we had to drive to Melrose that day for a burial. Two cars were written off on the way there with mourners in them. No one was injured, thank God, but two cars just drove off the road because they couldn't see where the road was. So that actually cost more money because we simply had to include a mileage cost for that as well. But the cost of the funeral basically depends upon how flash you want to be with a coffin and what you actually want. But you can certainly ring around and get prices from companies. A good way to do that, people choose to do that through prepaid funerals as well, is they get their costs beforehand so they know exactly what they're paying for. Because some companies do charge extra if they have to go out after hours. Some charge more if you want to have your loved ones dressed in the mortuary or things like that.
Do they have websites giving prices?
Most of the websites don't give prices. So, yeah, it's not very helpful, is it? But you can certainly ring them up and get prices because most of the funeral companies are ringing each other up a fair bit of the time checking what the opposition are charging anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Now, in the country, they still drive from the church to the cemetery and have the, you know, the queue of people driving slowly behind. Yep. You don't see, well, I don't see that in Adelaide anymore. Is that sort of not allowed anymore?
It's because a lot of times people are choosing just to have a one-location service. So Doug before was mentioning a girl, a young woman my age, who was a very good friend of mine, whose funeral we had about 4 weeks ago at Brougham Place. And then they were having a private burial at Enfield. So we had the public funeral service of the church, and then about 50 of us only went to the cemetery. So most of the people who went to the funeral didn't go to the cemetery. And then we had a wake afterwards as well, but that was by invitation only. A lot of people choose these days, like most people would have a service in a church if they're having a cremation, and no one would go to the crematorium because you're not going to do anything there unless you were Buddhist and you wanted to see the coffin go into the cremator, which is called witnessing the charging. And so in some cultures they do want to see that, but most of the time with a cremation they just have the service in the one location and the coffin leaves in the hearse. But if you want to follow the hearse to the cemetery, you will, you can, but you'll usually get charged more for that because the funeral director's time is taking longer.
And do most funerals have tea and bickies afterwards?
Yeah, COVID willing, yes. Most of the time they do. Catering is up to the family and what they want to do. Most funeral companies have got contracts with different caterers so the family can have what they want. I will tell you that funerals are obviously becoming more and more expensive. But part of that is because funerals are getting more and more complicated. A busy day, when I was still working as a funeral director, a busy day was two or three funerals. 30 years ago, I can remember doing eight in a day. And we would do funerals on the hour because, you know, like these days, if a family want to have memorial cards, it can take an hour and a half, 2 hours to sort out the memorial cards because you've got to choose the size of the card, what photographs you want on it, what colour printing, what size printing, what font of printing. When I started, there was no such thing as a memorial card. You know, the priests and ministers would usually do services. Some of them were doing them on the hour. We spoke about that a little earlier. There was a couple of priests who we could pretty much count on. You'd start the service now, walk out the back, 12 and a half minutes later, come in for the committal. These days, every funeral is quite different and every funeral is individual. And because of that, the cost of funerals has gone up as well. Because, as I said, instead of being able to do 6 to 8 funerals in a day, most funeral companies, you're struggling to do 2 in a day now. And so you're paying for those hours that the funeral crews are working. People expect more and more as well. So every, you know, 10 years ago, we didn't worry about things like DVD. Things are changing all the time. We've got to remember that. 10 years ago, people didn't know anything about having a DVD presentation. You might go 2 weeks now and not have one before you get a funeral where they don't have one. Everyone has DVD presentations now. And live streaming, but there are other things which are changing. For example, if I was writing up a prepaid funeral now, we no longer include notices in the paper. Why? Because most of the time when we're arranging a funeral, the family have already told everyone on FaceTime. Either that, or the other thing is that there's no guarantee in 3 years' time there's going to be an advertiser. Or if there is, it'll be online.
Be on Trove.
Sorry?
It'll all be on Trove in a few years' time.
Yeah. And so, for example, now when we do write-up prepaids, we don't include any money for ads in the paper because the ads in the paper are basically now an optional extra because most families are telling us, look, it's already online and we've already put all the details there, so why would we bother? Let's save our money, which is fair enough because you'll see some of those ads in the paper that are about a column long. That's about $1,800 worth.
Yes, it's nice to know who the children and grandchildren are.
Yeah, it is, but as I said, a lot of that's online these days. I can't get over how many are in Saturday's paper. Yeah, page after page after page of them, isn't there? The reason for that is a couple of years ago, Saturday was the most expensive paper. It was about 40% more than the rest of the week. But now the advertiser's exactly the same price. They charge for notices every day of the week. The other thing is it used to be you paid for lineage of wording and then you paid extra for photographs, whereas now you just get charged by the centimetre. So it's not a matter of how many lines of wording, it's how many centimetres of space you use.
I had to go out, so you might have covered this. If you just wanted to go to the funeral director and just view in a room, is that the same as in dispossession one you...
Disposition.
Or would, you know, there'd obviously be some charge involved with that?
There is, but that's included in their charges because in South Australia the law is that every time you have a funeral service, by law, someone needs to see that person and sign an identification form. The only time the body is not identified like that is when they cannot be identified. For example, you know, they might be decomposed or burnt when DNA or dental records are used. But at other times, for every funeral service, there has to be some form of identification. And if the family choose to have a viewing, they can. You need to be aware, though, that just the general public can't turn up for a viewing. They need to have permission of the people whose deceased it is.
Well, thank you very much, Dan.
That's right.
That was very entertaining and very interesting. And I should also mention that we owe our thanks to Judith Perling, because it was Judith who obviously knew of Ian and organised this for him to come and talk to us. And so, by way of thanks, I would ask Helen to present you with a small gift.
Thank you very much. That's very, very generous. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's lovely. Thank you, folks.
Thank you all for coming, and there'll be tea and coffee in the foyer.
And if you would like to have one of these documents, please feel free to take them. As I said, I've done up about 15 of each of them, so...